Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. A real joy to be with all of you today. As many of you have been listening to this program, you've been aware that I've been coming to you from Taiwan over the past 10 days or so. And I'm really glad to be back in the United States and to be able to speak with you about my time in Taiwan, and I'll be reflecting on it in different ways over the next few days or so. One of the things I do want to speak about today that was immediately apparent to me had to do with how spoiled we are in the West and how starving the Church is in the East. And my commentary is going to be on that for the first segment. That in my preaching tour of the nation of Taiwan, and I really was traveling, quite frankly, the north and the south of the entire nation, I noticed a tremendous hunger for the very things that you and I simply take for granted here in the West, the post-Christian West, sure, or the neo-pagan West, whatever suits your fancy. The fact of the matter is we sit on the heritage of Christendom, of Judeo-Christianity. We sit on the heritage of the natural law and the foundational frameworks of divine revelation that Christianity essentially built. All the structures of human flourishing come from those sources here in the West. In the East, however, the sources of human existence and any civilization thereof that can be found there can still be traced to societal structures. Now, don't get me wrong, Western influence created a lot of the flourishing there, but the societal structures are decidedly Eastern in religion and philosophy. And so the people there are starving for basic truths that we take for granted. I want to address some of those. We go on from there to speak with Ed Clancy of Age of the Church in Need. He's going to update us on how the war in Iran is impacting the area's Christian population. And then finally, we speak with Philip Freeman. Ireland's patron saint has long been shrouded in legend, but the true story of St. Patrick is more inspiring than the myths let on. Philip Freeman joins us to bring the historic St. Patrick and his world vividly to life. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, March 17th. It's the Feast of St. Patrick. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Pope Leo will make a virtual appearance during a National Constitution Center event marking the 250th anniversary of U.S. independence after declining an invitation from the Trump administration to join 4th of July festivities. The National Constitution Center announcing that the Pope will receive its 38th annual Liberty Medal on July 3rd. He's expected to deliver virtual remarks to attendees gathered outside the center on Independence Mall in Philadelphia. President Trump's top counterterrorism official has stepped down over the Iran war. In a post on X, National Counterterrorism Center Director Joe Kent says he can't in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran, adding that Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it's clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel, end quote. The clock is starting on the Save America Act in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader John Thune is holding a vote today to open debate on the voter ID measure.
At the end of the day, I just don't know how you defend a position. You need to be a citizen in this country, not only to register to vote, but also to be able to show an ID when you vote.
The Save America Act would require people to provide proof of citizenship in person to register to vote and would implement a national requirement for photo ID. Democrats united in opposition, arguing that the ID requirements would disenfranchise millions of voters. FlightAware reporting thousands of delays and cancellations as a line of thunderstorms hit the East Coast. Long lines are also being reported at major airports as TSA agents work without pay due to the partial government shutdown. The 200-year-old company behind the Merriam-Webster dictionaries is suing OpenAI. Encyclopedia Britannica says that the AI firm is infringing on its copyrighted material by using the dictionary's online articles to train its technology. Britannica says it's cannibalized its web traffic and has led to a loss of ad revenue. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I just returned from a preaching tour across the nation of Taiwan, and for 10 days I watched something that many Western Christians simply don't recognize anymore. I watched people lean in hungrily for the truth. I watched their faces brighten when they heard simple truths, like the human person possesses an inherent dignity that doesn't come from the state or bureaucrats or party structures or economic output or even family prestige in society or your academic score or even your public usefulness. I watched these men and women receive with astonishment simple claims like the human being has worth because he's made by God and for God. That's a basic truth in the biblical vision, but in much of the developed and even underdeveloped East, that truth still is revelatory. That fact alone should shame many of us in the West. We live among overflowing shelves of catechisms and commentaries, podcasts, talks, institutes, schools, conferences, you name it. But still, many Catholics drift through life with a half-formed faith and a fully formed appetite for comfort. In Taiwan, though, many believers are trying to build a serious Christian life with not only far fewer resources, they also have far fewer laborers and a much thinner civilizational memory of biblical categories. So yes, they're hungry. And a hungry people usually hear the gospel better than a spoiled people. What struck me repeatedly was how foundational the missing categories still are. In the biblical and Catholic worldview, the human person is not raw material for the state. That he's never a replaceable cog inside an administrative machine, the way the Chinese CCP declares. The human person is not a social unit whose value rises and falls with productivity, which is typical of Asian mindsets. Scripture opens with man and woman created in the image of God, which means our dignity is received before any achievement that we could have, before social recognition, before success, even before the concept of utility. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. And likewise, the Catechism teaches us that the dignity of the human person is rooted in his creation in the image and likeness of God. Now, that's a radically liberating truth. And when, well, the Jewish faith and then Christianity brought that truth into society and global history, it was not only novel, it was somewhat scandalous. In the East, societies are shaped by intense performance pressure, status hierarchies, and a social tyranny of expectation. That biblical vision actually gives people something even deeper than that than nonsensical abstract dignity. It gives them an exposure to covenant. It tells them that God doesn't just issue commands from a distance. He pours out his own life. He wants to bind himself to his people. He calls them into communion. He invites a filial response from them. In Christ, that message reaches its summit because for us men and for our salvation, he came down from heaven. Christianity, therefore, offers all of us far more than just moral advice or even a ceremonial structure. It offers us a divine adoption, sacramental participation, union with the living God, all of which is novel and frankly scandalous to human history and imagination. There are also several habits that are common in East Asian settings that will resist the Judeo-Christian inheritance that we benefit from and take for granted. One is a collectivism that's detached from a transcendental worldview. Now, what do I mean by that? A human person is interpreted primarily through, their value is interpreted primarily through their family or their clan or their nation or their social order or their race. The other is a utilitarian kind of view of the human person, that the person's value is chiefly defined by his usefulness. The other is a shame-centered social ethic. External harmony can eclipse the interior need for the conversion of the soul. And then finally, syncretism. Religious claims are all blended. In fact, the Taiwanese people called this a false sense of respect, that where your religion is your religion, mine is mine, and I need to respect you so much that I cannot give you Jesus. Because to give you Jesus, to evangelize, would be a shameful disrespect of your desire to espouse whatever faith you want. Now, you add to that this modern notion of empiricist materialism. I know those are big words, but what that means is enjoy what you have. Only what you can touch and feel is what matters. So consumer pleasure, that's what defines modern Taiwanese society and much of Asian society today. So you get a society that is wealthy in devices, but they're really poor in their proper understanding of the human person and the human person's relationship to the divine. And Taiwan in particular feels those tensions acutely. On the one side, they are astonishingly sophisticated in their industry, in their civility, frankly, in intelligence and energy. They are a truly industrious people. But on the other side, there's a familiar modern disease that all developed societies have. Shrinking birth rates, expanding loneliness, transactional relationships, a polished sense of self-centeredness. In fact, from the millennial generation onwards in Taiwan, all of them are chasing immediate enjoyment, burning through any money that they earn, and they're bleeding hope in the process because there is no reason to save up for the future. And in that atmosphere, well, the gospel can barely be planted. That's why missionary work there matters so profoundly. The faith is still in its infancy in Taiwan. Sure, it has life and sincerity and zeal and genuine devotion in some pockets, but it barely has roots. It doesn't have depth, it barely has formation, and it has very distinctly local apologetic grammar. It's like, I'm sorry I'm Catholic. Too many catechetical materials that are available there are translations of Western resources that are written for Western assumptions and Western ways of thinking, Western debates, Western philosophical instincts. And those are useful, don't get me wrong. They were very helpful to me in studying my way into the faith, but I'm personally grateful for them, but for a Taiwanese Christian, a Hong Kong Christian, a Macau Christian, a mainland Chinese Christian, they're navigating a very different intellectual landscape. Their questions are different. Their inherited categories are different. The social pressures they face are different. And the vocabulary of their persuasion is different. That's why what's needed is more than importation of what we do in the United States. What's needed is the grace to make the gospel incarnate there. So yes, the church must bring the same gospel. I'm not talking about enculturation. I'm talking about making sure that the gospel is used to speak into the issues of Taiwan. That same apostolic faith, but addressing the cultural contexts of the East right now with intelligence, yes, with tenderness, but with boldness. The Second Vatican Council was beautiful in stating that the Pilgrim Church is missionary by her very nature. Paul VI, he said evangelizing is in fact the grace and vocation proper to the church. It's her deepest identity. She exists in order to evangelize. That's not for specialists, that's for all the baptized. That's the ordinary duty of a baptized Christian. All of us must remember the infinite value of individual souls, and souls are worth everything. The church has always understood this. The salvation of souls is our supreme concern. The Catechism reminds us of this. And that's why, even as we see the decline of the church in numerous developed areas that were once deeply Christian, we need to understand that there are souls who have never even heard of the gospel. And so my heart genuinely broke for the Christians I met in Taiwan. Many of them are carrying the weight of cultural headwinds that limit their exposure to the gospel. They need more priests, more catechists, more translators, more writers, more preachers, more missionaries, more Catholics in the West who actually care enough to give, to pray, to go, and to build. They need a church that remembers that evangelization is the heart and pulse of Catholicism. Pray for Taiwan. The vineyard is vast, but the laborers are still few. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Feeling worn out, overwhelmed, or just plain tired of feeling tired as a parent? Well, you're not alone. Parenting can drain even the most faithful moms and dads, especially at this time of year.
Join us, Dr. Craig and Lisa Popcheck, for a free Ave Maria Radio webinar, Reclaiming the Joy of Parenting, Overcoming Burnout, on Wednesday, March 18th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern.
Get practical, faith-filled tools to recharge your batteries and rediscover the joy of raising Catholic kids. Register now at AveMariaRadio.net.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Ed Clancy of Aid to the Church in Need has an update on how the war in Iran is impacting the area's Christian population. Ed is the outreach director of Aid to the Church in Need USA. Ed, great to speak with you again. How are you?
Same as here. I'm doing well, thank you, and yourself?
I'm well, and very grateful to touch base with you about Iran. So tell us what we know about the Christians in Iran prior to this recent conflict.
Well, the Christian community in Iran is very isolated and small, especially considering, you know, the 90-plus million population of Iran. It's anywhere from 135 to maybe 250,000. There are a good number of other hidden Christians who might have been converts from Islam, who don't outwardly profess that they are Christians because of fear of reprisal. And so the community is small, and for the most part, the known community is isolated into places where the government has allowed Christianity to exist, not necessarily to move about or do anything like that. But the real effects of the war in Iran is everywhere else, essentially. It's affecting the multiple countries that surround Iran in so many ways. Christian populations in many of these places where they're a minority, tourism is a very important component of their economies, of their ability to earn a living. And it's essentially down to zero. And then you have places like Lebanon, because of Hezbollah's alignment with Shia Islam, that they are now targeted and also have been active in fighting back or launching missiles into Israel. So there are places in Lebanon where the small Christian communities, which is, you know, they're very parochial, they're very centralized, are being forced to move away from homelands that they've had for, you know, centuries.
Given how small they are, how much do things like, say, the war, displacement, and political instability affect the Christian community, and not just in Iran. One of the things you highlight, too, is it's also in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Gaza and the West Bank.
Correct. Well, it's sort of an interesting mix of difficulties and opportunities. Because they're so small, in a sense, they've already learned to exist, you know, in this very, very extreme minority. So these hardships, although it may drive some away, the communities have had the strength to remain in spite of all that they've gone through over the past century or more. But then on the other side, you see that there are places in the region. I guess the prime example of, you know, a drastic decrease in Christian population would be Iraq. The turn of the century, around the year 2000, there were well over a million Christians in Iraq. Now there are anywhere between 100 and 200,000 left. So we're talking about between a 70 and 85% decrease in the population. But then again, you know, in a place like Iraq, you see that there's this sort of rebirth in a place like Erbil, where the center might have been Baghdad. Erbil has had a lot of progress. Catholic University of Erbil, the first Catholic in name institution of its type anywhere in the Middle East, medical school opening, dental school, things like that. But because they are so young in many ways, you know, just a decade or so in existence, they also are very vulnerable because they don't have that base. They don't have the population centers to keep them going. But once again, Christian communities in these regions, and, you know, it is thanks to the support that they get from outside of their communities that they're able to remain. And, you know, the chief area of support for them is within the church, allowing priests and nuns and churches and schools to stay and to not leave. In fact, Father Al-Rahi, a Lebanese Maronite priest who was killed just about a week ago, was essentially advised, like many of the Christians, to leave. But he refused to do so. He stayed in his town, and he was actually killed because he was responding to somebody in need after a missile or one of the bombs hit his town in Lebanon. And then there are a couple of other families who have been likewise affected. A father of a few young children was killed, and a young man of about 22 years old was also killed. Another thing that's happening in places like Lebanon is, you know, the places where Christians live, they have centuries-old industries like olive groves. Some of them have wineries. And because of what's happening, they're afraid to leave, because if they leave, they know that everything will be destroyed and they'll have nothing. In fact, we've heard numerous stories of sort of the man of the house, the oldest male of the family who remain in the houses, so that that there would be something to come back to, because their fear is that they will lose everything. In places like Lebanon, because of the destruction of the economy through different banking issues, what has happened because of ISIS, there was COVID, there were numerous other attacks, that they have used all their savings just to stay there. So they're really now left to living off the goodwill and the support of communities outside of Lebanon. But they also don't want to live that way. They want to go back to their homes. They want to have businesses. So they're really taking great chances with their lives and to protect them to have a future in this area.
Considering all of that, could you also comment on the safety and general reality of religious freedom for Christians in that part of the world, specifically Iran as well?
Well, Iran is a place where there's little, if no, real religious freedom. Christian communities do exist because of the strict laws of Iran. Mm-hmm. They do not allow converts. They do not allow proselytization, as they call it. So you can't even speak to someone else about Christianity without fear of being arrested, attacked, or even killed. And then you get situations where communities that live together, small Christian communities, live amongst Muslims. If there's an intermarriage between a Christian and a Muslim, the Muslim cannot convert. In fact, the presumption is that the Christian will convert, and any children that are born in that marriage will be Muslim. So that puts, you know, sort of harsh penalties or pressures on the Christians. The other thing is, because Christians in these communities oftentimes that are very well educated, education is a very important aspect of life in the Christian community. They often are overeducated for their opportunities, which is another draw that pulls them away. And so you have this sort of mix of lack of opportunity, of danger, of lack of freedom. And it really is quite, you know, impressive that they have remained through it all, that they stick to it, because they do realize that leaving is essentially maybe the end of their culture. And then if you go into other places like Lebanon, because the Christians and the Muslims have coexisted for so long, and the Christians are guaranteed a place in the government, there's much more protection for Christianity in those areas. In a place like Iraq, outside of Erbil, it is tolerated, but not necessarily safe to be, you know, a Christian in public. Now, communities like Erbil, where there are, you know, maybe 150,000, 125,000 Christians in that city, they have the ability to exist in a large enough community that there is a sense of protection.
We're out of time. I was going to ask about, therefore, the reality of displacement and how the Christians are handling that. But Ed, thank you very, very much for joining us to speak about this.
Yeah, Christians remain. That's the whole thing. They don't stand up on it.
My guest has been Ed Clancy, Outreach Director of Age of the Church in Need USA. We've been talking about the state of the Christian church in Iran specifically. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking, and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here. And I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen. Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
What is conversion? The Catholic Catechism says there are two kinds of conversions. The first is baptism, which removes original sin and washes away all other sin. The second is the conversion of the heart from sin to the merciful love of God. It is Jesus who calls us to this conversion. The time is fulfilled, he said. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. A perfect example of this conversion is St. Peter, who, after denying his master three times, burst into tears of repentance. St. Ambrose describes the two conversions as the water and tears, the water of baptism and the tears of repentance. Jesus' call to conversion is not first and foremost to outward penance, such as sackcloth and ashes, but to an interior conversion of the heart, without which penances are sterile and futile. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Once again, blessed St. Patrick's Day. Ireland's patron saint has long been shrouded in legend, but the true story of St. Patrick is far more inspiring than the myths. Philip Freeman joins us to bring the historic Patrick and his world vividly to life. Philip is a professor of humanities at Pepperdine University Siva College, author of St. Patrick of Ireland, a biography. Dr. Freeman, good to speak with you. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
So, I guess I should ask, the concentrated work that you did, especially in terms of patching the historical records, which you did very aptly, you clearly have a personal vested interest in the life of St. Patrick. I invite you to share that.
Yeah, I first read the story of St. Patrick, or excuse me, his letters, when I was a graduate student, so many years ago. I had heard the story, just like everybody had from before that, but I was just enchanted and entranced and amazed by these two letters that Patrick himself wrote in Latin sometime in the 5th century A.D., of course. And he, I just was amazed at a man who revealed so much of himself, all of his doubts and struggles and difficulties, and yet his faith in God and his triumph. So I ever since I was in graduate school, I just wanted to write a book about him. So I wrote that book, St. Patrick of Ireland, a few years ago, and I've been doing various editions and works on Patrick ever since.
The two letters that you bring up that were written by Patrick's hand are Letter to the Soldiers of Caroticus and His Confessions. Would you please shed some light on what each of these contain and what they reveal to us about Patrick?
Yes, the letter to the soldiers of Caroticus is a short letter, but it is fiery and angry because it is written to a British tyrant, really a warlord, who has sent his soldiers over to Ireland and kidnapped some of Patrick's converts. He said that they had just been baptized, some of them, and so they took these converts back to Britain to sell into slavery. And so he wrote this letter to, it's really an open letter to anybody in Britain who'll listen. And he says, you've got to free these people. You can't do this to your brothers and sisters in Christ. And so that's the first letter. The confession is, it has the same title as St. Augustine's Confessions, but it's really much more of a declaration in many ways. It's the story of Patrick's life, the story of his ministry, the many, many difficulties, both personal and professional, that he went through in his efforts to evangelize the Irish. It is, both of these letters are just marvelous. They're the earliest thing we have from Ireland, really from the British Isles altogether, And they're a marvelous source for historians and scholars of religion, but they're just a wonderful inspiration, I think, to anybody personally.
Now, his letters, like you mentioned, they provide us a bit of a glimpse into the man, his zeal, his fervor, but they're not the only sources from which you patch together this rather extensive look into his autobiography, into his history. What are some of the other sources that we know are reliable about his life?
Well, not very many, honestly. What I did is I took these two letters, and they are certainly the main sources. But I also looked at archaeology. I looked at other supporting literature, letters from bishops and such. Nobody ever mentions Patrick during his lifetime except Patrick himself. And so you have to rely on those two letters primarily, mm-hmm. because there really isn't anything else.
Now, from there, then, you really have provided us a very extensive picture of his life. So tell us about his childhood, the way he grew up, his culture, the way he spent his time, the language he spoke.
Sure. He was born in probably the year 395, maybe 400 or so. We don't really know. But he was born in Britain while it was still a Roman province. It's right at the very end of Roman control of Britain. But Patrick is born into a wealthy and noble family of Roman Britons of British descent. And so they would have spoken British, which eventually would turn into Welsh. But they also would have spoken Latin. Patrick would have been bilingual from a very early time. His Patrick's grandfather was a priest, a Christian priest. His father was a deacon. So Patrick was very much raised in the church, even though Christianity was still a minority religion at the time. But he was very much raised in the church. But he says that at least by the time he was a teenager, he had abandoned all belief in God. He said, "I was an atheist."
We have record of a particular grievous sin of his youth that, as far as we know, came back to haunt him, if you will. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting mystery. We don't know what the sin is, but we know he did something about when he was about the age 15 that when it was discovered decades later, got him in real trouble. And it would have to be something quite serious for that to happen, something like murder or apostasy or sacrificing in a temple or something. And mm-hmm. so it was something quite serious that Patrick did, but we don't know what it is.
Now, from there, we have a bit of a picture of his life. What was his faith like? He was the son of clergymen, a family of clergy, but he himself was not fully embraced in the Catholic faith.
No, he wasn't. I'm sure he was. He went through the motions, and he certainly learned the Bible stories very well. But he, by the time he is a teenager, he has says he has abandoned the faith. But he then is kidnapped and taken to Ireland. And that is when he rediscovers these childhood stories that he had been told about the stories of the gospel, the stories of Moses and the Exodus from Egypt. All of the things he had learned as a child came back and provided a refuge for him, a hope, a shining light in a very dark time in his life.
And that then gives us the idea of the kind of young man who was approached by the slave raiders in Britain.
Yes. Yeah, he was kidnapped from his family's estate. He was very wealthy. His family was very wealthy. He's taken over. He serves for 6 or 7 years as a slave in Ireland in just miserable conditions. He says he herded sheep was one of his jobs, and herding sheep is not much fun. So he one day hears a voice in his sleep, in a dream, and it says, "Patrick, it's time to go home. Your ship is ready." And he wakes up, and he has no idea what this is. But then he falls back asleep, and he hears the voice again saying, "Your ship is ready. It's time to go." And so Patrick makes a great leap of faith, and he he escapes from his Irish master. He travels across really all of Ireland. He finds a ship. He talks his way on, and he eventually gets back to Britain, where he sees his family again.
Even before Patrick became the stalwart preacher of Catholicism in Ireland, Ireland as a nation had a sense of sacredness. There was a kind of concept of Ireland as being sacred. Can you speak to the religious milieu that he was a slave in?
Yes. Ireland at the time, we're talking about the early 5th century, was a polytheistic society. It had many different gods, very much like ancient Rome or ancient Greece. They would have, you know, they had gods for water, they had gods for the sky, they had gods for every spring and every lake. They were certainly a very spiritual people. That is true. And this religion that the pagan Irish had was overseen by the Druids, who were a professional class of priests. They were sacrificers, and they performed many different functions in the religion.
I am talking with Dr. Philip Freeman. He joins us now to bring the historic story of St. Patrick of Ireland, and to today being his feast day, to share with us a bit more of the historical context in the life of St. Patrick. Continuing on the other side of the break, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces." If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we? The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Why would Jesus choose to be present under the humble circumstances of bread and wine? It is highly fitting, says the Catechism of the Catholic Church, that Christ should have wanted to remain with his church in this unique way. In his Eucharistic presence, Jesus is always within his church in a sacramental and mysterious manner. Saint Cyril counseled, "Do not doubt whether this is true, but rather receive the words of the Savior in faith, for he is the truth. He cannot lie." St. John Paul II wrote, "The church and the world have a great need of Eucharistic worship. Jesus awaits us in this sacrament of love." The Pope urged we, the faithful, not to refuse the Lord the time to meet with him, adoring him in contemplation, open to making amends for the serious crimes and offenses of the world. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the Church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Pete. I'm talking with Dr. Philip Freeman, author of St. Patrick of Ireland, a biography. So, Philip, to pick up on a point that you were making earlier about the milieu of Ireland at the time, there were a few stories that permeate the historical narratives of Ireland that I'd like to invite you to speak to as well.
Sure.
So, the Greek Diodorus Siculus and what he said about Ireland.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Diodorus Siculus said that Ireland was, the people who wrote about Ireland, and there aren't very many, they described it as a wild and savage place full of cannibals. It certainly had that reputation among the Greeks and the Romans. The Romans had actually thought about conquering Ireland, but then they thought, no, it's just not worth the trouble. But then the other, what little else we have on Ireland is none of it's flattering. talking about things like they don't have bees there, which they, of course, do. And one of them also says they don't have snakes in mm-hmm. Ireland, which just interestingly turns out to be true.
What about what Solinus or Solinus wrote about Ireland?
About the snakes, you mean? He says that Ireland is a place that has no snakes. Now, Solinus would have no idea. He would have heard this third or fourth hand, but he does happen to get it right. And of course, that feeds in very nicely to the St. Patrick story, because the story of Patrick expelling the snakes from Ireland, well, there aren't any snakes in Ireland, so Patrick must have kicked them out. So it fits together well.
And you also have a lot of savage stories, even by Jerome, about just about the general cannibalistic savagery of the people in Ireland.
Yes, the idea that they, that Irish raiders or Irish mercenaries serving in the Roman army would cook people, and honestly, we have no good evidence that the Irish were ever cannibals. This is a very typical sort of thing that the Greeks and the Romans would say about the people they considered to be barbarians.
Right.
Cannibalism was not at all popular in Ireland.
But you see, the point you were making, though, is that there was a bit of a reputation of this nation prior to Patrick getting there, and it certainly is nothing close to this post-Christian civilization of Ireland that we know today.
No, it's not. Ireland at the time that Patrick was there was divided into over 100 tribes, very much an agricultural place. It had no cities at all. Each of these little tribes was ruled over by a king, and it was there was a warrior class. It was really, for Patrick, I think it would have been like stepping back in time. They used chariot warfare in Ireland, which is something that they hadn't known in Greece and Rome since the Trojan Wars. So it was really a step back centuries in time for Patrick to go to Ireland. But having said all that, it was a very developed culture and society in terms of poetry, in terms of even science. The Druids were actually fairly decent scientists.
What about the practice of the economic and social practice of slavery in Ireland at the time?
Yeah, in Ireland they had slaves, of course, like they had really everywhere in the ancient world. In Ireland, it was a little bit different. They would buy foreign slaves. They would enslave people who were captured in wars in Ireland. But the one thing in Ireland is you could not work or buy your way out of slavery, which was something that you could do in Rome. If you worked hard enough and saved up enough money, you could buy your way out, but never in Ireland could that be done. And so the Irish, you could not free a slave. That was impossible. And the slaves in Ireland, in fact, the Christians, there were Christians in Ireland before St. Patrick, but many of them were slaves who had been kidnapped in Britain, especially women, and brought back to Ireland to serve in slavery.
In fact, slaves were essentially had all of the rights of property. They didn't have human rights.
Right, exactly. Absolutely no human rights.
Now, from there then, we discover that Patrick has a kind of resurgence, or at least a first deep commitment to his faith in his time as a slave in Ireland. Tell us about that.
Yes, I think he had literally nowhere else to turn for comfort when he was a slave in Ireland. He had been ripped away from everything, and he remembered the God of his youth and became a devout Christian in Ireland while he was still a slave. And so he continues his work, herding the sheep, but he now prays. He says 100 times during the day and 100 times at night, and gets the nickname Holy Boy, I think, among his fellows there in Ireland.
He starts having some real supernatural and spiritual experiences. Share with us some of those.
Yes, he did. He had the dream I mentioned, a couple of dreams that called him to escape, to find this boat and go back to Britain. But he talks, he doesn't work miracles in the sense that we have the later stories about Patrick. We have in his two letters, he talks about what he does, and he never mentions any miracles. He says that sometimes he has a sense of what's going to happen. But he doesn't do anything, we would put in the miraculous category at all. But he definitely, during his time in Ireland as a slave, turns to Christ, turns to God, and becomes a truly committed Christian.
As you mentioned earlier, the dream and the voices are what leads him to finally leave Ireland, that the boat was ready for him.
Yes. Yep, they lead him down to this bay, probably in southern Ireland. He goes to the boat. The captain there, he explains, I would like to come with you. The captain says, no way are you coming with us. The captain knew he was an escaped slave. He didn't want to get in trouble. So he says no, but then apparently he changes his mind and allows Patrick to come on, and they eventually sail back to Britain.
And upon returning home, this was quite frankly the return of the prodigal son. Tell us about what that reunion was like, and how was Patrick's life reestablished?
Well, he says that when he finally reached home, his parents couldn't believe it. They had given him up for dead 7 years earlier. And so they were, just thrilled beyond words to see him, and they welcome him back into the home and, into his life of nobility and his life of luxury. He is very much, it sounds like the end of the story there. He escapes from slavery. He finds his way home. And in another story, he just would have gone on with his life there in Britain. But God has other plans for him.
And so while he is in Britain, he not only deepens his life in faith, he winds up becoming a clergyman like his father.
Yes, he does. He decides, he gets more dreams that call him and say, you need to go back to Ireland, but he needs to be trained first. And so he goes and he gets clerical training. He gets training as a priest. He's eventually going to be ordained as a bishop, but he is trained as a priest in preparation for returning to Ireland as an ordained minister.
And like you mentioned, dreams and visions that essentially call him back. And so now, being an ordained minister, being a bishop, no less, he returns to Ireland, clearly not a slave, in a position of authority, but it's not all easy.
Not at all. For one reason is the way Ireland is set up. It's not the Roman Empire. It's divided into over 100 different kingdoms, each of which is fiercely independent. So he has to work kingdom by kingdom, which really ends up being valley by valley. He has to go to the king. He has to get permission. He has to offer gifts to the king. It's a gift-giving society. So he offers these gifts in order to be allowed to preach and minister. He preaches the gospel and he seeks converts, but he also ministers to the Christians who are already there, most especially the slave women, the Christian slave women who've been kidnapped from Britain.
He was also Celestine was the one who considered sending him to Ireland anyway. So this wasn't just a personal divine calling. This was validated by his superiors.
Yes. He was sent by the church authorities to Ireland. So he was not a freelance bishop, as some people have called him by any means. He followed the rules of the church. He did it right, and he went over and did the work that the church had sent him to do.
How did the gospel land in Ireland, considering the very pagan nature of the faith in Ireland?
It was, and I think probably the Irish, they would have been open to new gods. The first thing Patrick had to do before he even talked about Christianity and Christ was to talk about the idea of a single God, which would have been novel and revolutionary to them. If Patrick had just come over and said, I want to tell you about a new God among the many gods of the heavens, they probably would have been quite open to that. But he says, no, there is really only one God. And so this would have been a great stumbling block. And Patrick said he had many converts during his years, and I think he did. But he also must have met a great deal of resistance, because what he was preaching was a very new kind of message.
And that message, frankly, transformed all of Ireland. Thank you very much, Philip, for joining us to talk about this.
Sure.
My guest has been Philip Freeman, Professor of Humanities at Pepperdine University Sevier College, author of St. Patrick of Ireland, a biography. Philip has done a good job of patching together the historical narrative of St. Patrick of Ireland. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.